Washington bureau chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal. And here are the issues. Donald Trump's campaign for president appeared to be unraveling after his attacks on the family of a war hero and other ill-advised remarks. More Republicans distanced themselves from the brash New Yorker, and some even endorsed Democrat Hillary Clinton. Critics of the Iran nuclear deal said the Obama administration had paid a, quote, ransom, unquote, for the release of American prisoners. The U.S. government did send Iran $400 million in cash in January. The money was compensation for U.S. weapons purchased by Iran and never delivered after the 1979 revolution. Turkey sent a parliamentary delegation to Washington to press for the extradition of Fethullah Gulen, the religious leader that the Turkish government accuses of orchestrating a failed coup. Rising anti-Americanism in Turkey is a growing concern for the Obama administration, which needs Turkey as a base to fight the group that calls itself the Islamic State. And finally, the Zika virus is spreading in Florida and remains one of many concerns for those competing in and attending the Olympic Games, which are getting underway in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Tom, let's start with the latest polls on Donald Trump. They do not look good for him.
No, they don't, Barbara. I always try to remind myself of something I've said for 40 years, which is overnight is a lifetime in politics. And we have about 90 days or so left. Anything could happen, but I agree with you. Both candidates got bounces from their conventions, meaning a positive bump in the polls as a result of all that primetime television exposure. But Clinton's bump was much higher than Trump's, and all of a sudden, what seemed to be a wafer-thin dead heat for the presidency has opened up in Hillary Clinton's favor. And I think what has Republicans really worried is that there are some places where Republicans, local candidates shouldn't be in trouble, are in trouble. All of a sudden, there's a very vigorous Senate race in New Hampshire where the incumbent Republican, Senator Kelly Ayotte, was tied with a very popular Democratic governor of the state. And all of a sudden, in recent days, she's down by 10 points. And it's clear that Mr. Trump at the moment is dragging down Republican office holders, and he has not unified the party. Mm-hmm. He has come out of his convention making one serious mistake ranging from serious to stupid. And there are no signs yet that he has been able to make the jump from a primary campaign to a national campaign, and he has paid the price in the polls, at least for now.
Yeah. Linda, I wrote, I think it was back in May when Trump clinched the nomination, I wrote a piece called The Unraveling of Donald Trump. This was when he spent 4 or 5 days going after a judge who was involved in a case against so-called Trump University, and Trump kept going on and on about how the guy was Mexican and therefore could not be fair. Of course, he was born in the United States. His parents were from Mexico. Mm-hmm. So I guess I was just a little premature. It seems that Judge Curiel wasn't the turning point or the straw that broke the camel's back, whatever you want. But it may have been Humayun Khan. Tell us about the controversy over the Khans.
Well, at the Democratic Convention, Humayun Khan, who was a captain in the Army and who was killed in Iraq in 2004, his parents got up at the Democratic Convention, and the mother was silent, stood silently behind the father, the image of the son behind them. The father denounced in very strong and passionate and moving terms, denounced Donald Trump and waved a copy of the Constitution.
Right.
You know, I will lend you my copy. You haven't read it, and I'll lend you my copy. It was one of the most, if not the most memorable moments of the entire Democratic Convention. And Donald Trump, in his inimitable way, instead of taking the criticism and praising the memory of Humayun Khan and his service to the country and acknowledging the grief of the parents, went after the parents.
Yeah.
And not only went after them for one day, he spent several days going after the Khans, to the point where it is causing even some diehard Trump fans to wonder if it wasn't a big mistake to nominate him. And this sort of triggered a cascade of events, including discussion within the Republican National Committee about what they might do if Trump were to drop out of the race. Now, there's no evidence that he's about to drop out, but
he doesn't like to lose, and he's down 10 points in a lot of polls.
Right, he doesn't like to lose, but he's also says he's not a quitter. He doesn't like quitters, which is what we saw, you know, he has taken off after others who quit. So pick your poison here, but there's also reportedly going to be an effort by some people close to Donald Trump, Newt Gingrich, Rudy Giuliani,
to intervene
and speak to his children. Now, his children are the path, his adult children are the path to Donald Trump. You talk to Ivanka and Don Jr. and Eric, they seem to have good heads on their shoulders. And unlike anybody else on the planet, can talk to their father and Trump's wife, Melania. But the children in particular are deeply involved in the campaign. And who knows what, if anything, will come out of that. But, you know.
Well, we should note that he actually did take back a mistake. But we'll talk about that in a bit. Tom, it wasn't just that he implied that Mrs. Khan was silent because she was forced to be silent as a Muslim and said various other things that were loathsome about a Gold Star parent. He also gave some interviews that once again called into question his judgment about foreign policy in general. He didn't seem to know that Russia had sent forces into eastern Ukraine. And this has led to kind of a cascade now of Republicans, independents, national security professionals distancing themselves from Donald Trump, and in some cases actually endorsing Hillary Clinton.
Right. And some of these individuals have now gone on the record to the point where the Clinton campaign has now released a new ad of senior Republican worthies, I guess, including a former director of the CIA, others saying that he would be dangerous.
I wanted to read, this is from Mike Morrell, who was acting director and deputy director of the CIA in the New York Times. He talked about Trump's obvious need for self-aggrandizement, his overreaction to perceived slights, his tendency to make decisions based on intuition, his refusal to change his views based on new information, his routine carelessness with the facts, his unwillingness to listen to others, and his lack of respect for the rule of law. I don't think I've ever seen such a stunning thing. The other thing, he also said that Trump's apparent bromance with Russian leader Vladimir Putin, in the intelligence business, we would say that Mr. Putin had recruited Mr. Trump as an unwitting agent of the Russian Federation. I mean, I don't think I've ever read such stunning things about
right.
a presidential candidate.
And in 48 years of covering presidents in Washington, I have never heard a sitting president be so harsh about a prospective replacement Donald Trump. President Obama has become, rabid is not a fair term, but he has become very forceful, very vigorous in articulating his belief that Donald Trump is unfit to serve. He did it again in recent days at a press conference at the Pentagon and basically invited the Republican Party to get rid of Mr. Trump. Now, I believe that has not happened since 1953, well over 50 years, 60 years, where a sitting president has been so harsh about a contender. And it's interesting because some political observers believe that by being so vocal, President Obama has made it harder for Republicans who are agonizing about Trump to go public because, you know, Obama is such a polarizing figure, even though his polls continue to go up.
Yeah.
But it speaks to the fact that President Obama believes fervently that Trump is not fit to be president. And it's really quite extraordinary.
Linda, one of the ways in which Trump has made it easier for Republicans to distance themselves is his own refusal to endorse for re-election the most important elected Republican, namely Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House. And I think these kinds of activities also are just, putting the Republican establishment into absolute conniptions.
Right. No, Trump is skating on very thin ice, and it just shows how petulant he can be. Because Paul Ryan, and he mirrored the exact same language that Paul Ryan had used several months ago in his hesitancy about endorsing Trump. Paul Ryan did not initially endorse Trump. He said he wasn't there yet.
Right.
Same language comes back at Ryan. But I have to say, all this elite Republican Washington establishment opinion about Trump is one thing. But you have to wonder, you know, below that, at the level of the voting public, the rank and file Republicans and voters who aren't identifying with one party or the other and whose vote may in fact be up for grabs, I'm not sure how much of that really penetrates. And I think the Democrats have to be careful not to become overconfident.
Absolutely. And we should point out that Trump raised a lot of money in the month of July, something over $80 million, which is a record for him.
And much of that was from small donors, which is not the way it has happened for him. And he's got something like 21 or 22 big ticket fundraisers over the next 6 weeks or so. I mean, I continue to believe that this is going to come down to the first debate at Hofstra University in Long Island on September the 26th. I think by the end of that week, that's a Monday night.
We'll know.
And I think by the end of that week, we will probably know who the next president is going to be. But it's too early to write Trump off, but his numbers are not good, and something dramatic has got to happen in that campaign for him to be having a credible chance to be president. He could be president. I mean, stranger things have happened, but the metrics, as they say, do not look very good for him right now.
Linda, he did take something back, though. He had been insisting for several days that he had seen a film of U.S. cash being sent to Iran, that he'd actually seen the money arrive. Mm-hmm. And he took it back in a tweet and acknowledged that what he had seen was a movie of American prisoners being released in Switzerland. So I suppose there is a possibility for adult intervention every now and then.
Perhaps a tiny step forward for Trump to actually admit a mistake.
Okay. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of El Monitor. And joining me today are Tom DeFrank of National Journal and Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor. This is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/archive/issues-in-the-news. Linda, let's get back to this question of did the United States, did the Obama administration pay ransom for the release of five Americans who had been held in Iran? They were released at the same time as the nuclear deal went into full implementation. Was it a ransom?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And if you watched President Obama's press conference at the Pentagon, he looked visibly baffled by the whole issue. He correctly pointed out that the handing over of this money to Iran was announced by the U.S. government in January. This was part of the deal. The new piece of information that came out in the Wall Street Journal article was that it was delivered in cash on an airplane and simultaneous to the release of the hostages.
Well, we're not exactly sure if it was simultaneous. I think it was around that time, whether it was 2 minutes before or 2 minutes after, we don't know.
Right. So you can make both cases. You can argue that because they happened at roughly the same time, that it was in effect a ransom, even though it was already Iran's money. This was money that it had put forth decades ago for an arms deal that never took place. Right. And then because of sanctions and the lack of a banking relationship between the U.S. and Iran, had to be delivered in cash. So is it a ransom or not? Well, the problem with this is that somebody who wants to go after both the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State, the beginnings of the talk with Iran, not at the time of the hostage release, of course, you can argue that it was a ransom. So it's the optics are problematic, even though you can argue the other side quite persuasively.
Yeah. Tom, is this going to have much resonance, do you think, in the campaign? I'm not really sure how big an issue Iran is for our presidential election.
Unless there's a, God forbid, a terror attack somewhere and it's definitively established that the Iranians were funding it, I don't think so. Basically, this is one of those issues where if you support the Iran deal, you think this is not a big deal. If you're vehemently opposed to the Iran deal, and the country is pretty evenly divided, you're going to think it was ransom. I think at the moment it is not going to resonate. And I don't want to go back to Trump except to say this is a legitimate issue, Iran and the $400 million. But these sorts of things, which the Trump people would like to be able to have some fun with in a political sense, are drowned out by the continuing problems of Mr. Trump and his kind of all of his semantic problems.
Right.
Yeah, exactly right. And so that's the problem. A lot of Trump's advisors say, we've got to talk about the economy because it's not doing very well, even though at the end of the week it added over a quarter of a million jobs.
Yeah.
And so...
what does he have to talk about?
Because it's all about Trump. Issues that Republicans think could be used against Hillary Clinton are not resonating at the moment.
Yeah. You know, I think for me, as somebody who follows Iran very closely, what's most disturbing is the fact that there is a segment of the Iranian regime that has always favored hostage taking. Mm-hmm. And that after the nuclear deal was signed, but before implementation, the Iranians picked up another Iranian-American, Siamak Namazi. After implementation, they picked up his 80-year-old father, Bakr, and they also picked up just recently an Iranian from San Diego named Robin Shahini. They also hold several other dual nationals, Linda. So I think the problem, and this is the legitimate issue, is that whenever money changes hands with Iran, even if it's for another purpose that's thoroughly justified, you do give the impression that you are willing to cough up money for hostages, which just encourages more hostage taking. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think there is a legitimate issue here, but as Tom points out, it's being buried by Trump's own mistakes.
Right, and I would back on the issue of the economy, mm-hmm. you know, as another example of how Trump is missing golden opportunities to go after the Democrats. A week ago, the second quarter economic growth figure came out at only 1.2%. Okay, so we had a good jobs report, but a week ago, bad economic growth number, Trump completely did not talk about that. That was just stunning political mistake.
Yeah, no, indeed. And I wonder if he'll mention the good jobs number. But let's move on to another issue that actually hasn't figured so much in our campaign, but is really a serious foreign policy issue, Tom, and that is this growing rift with the Turks. On July 15th, the night of July 15th, there was an attempted coup that was put down. 300 people were killed. The Turkish president was targeted himself personally, but survived. In the aftermath, there has been a huge purge. Tens of thousands of people in the military and in the judiciary, educational system have been thrown out of their jobs or arrested. And the Turks are blaming a man named Fethullah Gulen, who lives in the United States, has lived in Pennsylvania since 1999, demanding that the U.S. extradite him, not showing, as far as I know, conclusive proof that he was the one who ordered this coup attempt. But it's really casting a pall over U.S.-Turkish relations, isn't it?
It is indeed. President Erdogan is very angry about this. His ambassador to the United States recently said Turkey is not only a member of NATO, but it is a firm ally of the United States, and as such, Turkey should be given the benefit of the doubt. And when we say this man, in our view, is a terrorist, not a terrorist, but inciting rebellion and inciting overthrow of a democratically elected government, the United States owes us the benefit of the doubt on something like this. And I still continue to believe it's not likely that he will be extradited to Turkey, but it is certainly a source of friction, and Turkey is not without assets here, as we've discussed before. As we all know here, the United States Air Force has a huge presence at a Turkish air base in Incirlik, and I think a smaller presence at another air base at Izmir, but the Incirlik one is critical.
Yeah.
To aerial refueling operations, to all sorts of things related to the anti-terror efforts on the part of the United States. And it would be a real blow if there is more of a schism mm-hmm. between the U.S. and Turkey. And this is not a small problem. This is a big problem.
Yeah, Linda, they turned off the external electricity to Incirlik Air Base for a week.
Mm.
After the coup attempt, apparently the Americans, you know, there they had enough emergency power to mm-hmm. continue some of their missions against the Islamic State group, but they didn't have air conditioning at night. They were lying in bed sweating.
Mm.
Not the best thing if you have to fly a mission the next day. How serious do you think this rift is? I know Turkey has been a NATO ally practically mm-hmm. since the inception of NATO.
Right. I mean, this is serious, but to me, it's just part of the longstanding problems. I can't think of a better word. This is just the latest in a long series of episodes that just show just how very complicated the U.S. relationship with Turkey is. It's absolutely critical. That base is just absolutely critical to our efforts in the Middle East. And the United States does have leverage there, obviously. Turkey is very proud of its involvement in NATO. And, you know, there's a lot of conflict there, sort of internal psychological conflict, I think, with, about its relationship with the United States. And so this is just yet another example of how, for Obama, he almost can't win.
Yeah.
And how, and I think he is skilled at stepping back and sort of analyzing in real time sort of the psychological needs of the Turkish government and of Erdogan in needing to show some distance from the United States while also needing the United States very desperately. I remember when Erdogan was in town several months ago and was practically chasing President Obama
for
a meeting and for a photo op, and the president wouldn't give it to him, and it sort of was demeaning to Erdogan. So you get this is, there's just this long-standing kind of back and forth between the two of them that's that's just very awkward, but that's just life in the Middle East.
Yeah, it is. I want to turn now to another very important issue for the United States domestically and also, I guess, internationally potentially, Tom, and that's the Zika virus. There have been 15 confirmed cases of transmission of this virus in Florida in an area in Miami, but there's something like 2,000 other cases, people who contracted the disease overseas, came back to the U.S. There was a woman of Haitian extraction who actually gave birth to a baby with microcephaly. She had contracted Zika in Haiti. President Obama has spoken very critically of Congress, which went out on recess without even approving funding for dealing with Zika. How much of a health emergency is this going to cause?
I don't think it's going to be a huge health emergency. There are signs that the infestation in Florida seems, at the moment at least, to have been contained. But as you say, Barbara, basically anybody who flies anywhere in the world and comes in contact with somebody who may have been infected in some other country runs this risk. I mean, some female athletes have decided not to go to the Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro because of this very reason. Even some male athletes, including National Basketball Association superstars, have opted out. And so, and let's hope I'm right on this, that I don't believe it's going to be a catastrophic issue, but it is something that needs to be dealt with more aggressively and more vigorously than the U.S. government is dealing with it at the moment, especially in terms of the kind of funds you need to really knock this out.
To develop vaccines and so on, which can be done. Linda, Tom brought up the Rio Games, and Zika appears to be the least of their worries because it's now winter in Brazil, and so the mosquito populations are down. But, you know, Olympics have a way of sort of coming off okay, but when you look at the environmental issues, pollution, potential terrorism, it's no wonder there are going to be a lot of empty seats at the Games.
Absolutely. I mean, just reading the latest on the Olympics, are they ready? Mm-hmm. Is security ready? What are the health concerns? I mean, I've never seen an Olympics that looks more potentially catastrophic than this one. I mean, it may well be just fine. We may have some wonderful competitions and fascinating outcomes, but just reading the stories about the raw sewage pouring into the bay where some athletes will be competing, I mean, it just sounds absolutely dreadful. I'm not at all surprised there are so many empty hotel rooms in Rio.
Yeah, Tom, Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff is about to be impeached or is facing trial for that. We have a doping scandal with the Russians. This is an unusual Olympics.
It is. For a institution like the International Olympic Committee, which is always fending off some kind of nightmare in progress, this has the potential for being exponentially more problematic. It'll be interesting, but this is one you don't want to be there.
Yeah, well, let's hope it turns out for the best. Anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Wagner Roberts and Linus Rimkus. I'm Barbara Slavin, acting director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Adam Hsu. He's foreign affairs reporter for VOA's Mandarin service. Our topic on this edition of the program, trafficking in persons and women's rights. Our guest, Monique